You're listening to the Art of Dying Well podcast, making death and dying something we can all talk about.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the Art of Dying Well podcast. It hasn't escaped my attention that I owe you one. It's been a little bit of a while, and I'm really sorry for that, but we're back. And we're back with a really interesting guest, because we have Father Patrick van der Voorst, who has appeared on this podcast before. More on that in a minute. Priest, precentor, interesting one, I'm coming back to that as well. Artificionado, founder of the bewilderingly good Christian.art. Please check that out if you haven't already. Former auctioneer in another life, entrepreneur, Belgian TV personality. Can we say that? I don't know. Dragon's Den contestant. Some might remember those days. And a million other things. Your eyes aren't rolling, but I wouldn't blame you if they were. Father Patrick van der Voorst, how are you?
I'm very well, James. Thank you for the quite introduction.
Quite a list of titles. No. Look, I've got to ask you that bit. I think people are going to grapple with the priest bit and understand it. Mm. What is a precentor?
I look after all the things that go on publicly up inside Westminster Cathedral, so the front-facing things of Westminster Cathedral. So I look after the liturgy, help with the music, put the orders of service together, look after the sacristy.
Small job then.
Well, keeps us busy enough. But a very enjoyable job, I have to say, because obviously I spend a lot of time inside the fabric of the building, inside the cathedral itself. And so you always bump into people and parishioners and visitors, guests. And so it's a great opportunity to talk to people, which is a part I very much enjoy.
And did you see this life coming when you were an auctioneer and an art expert?
I didn't see it coming at all, because I didn't even know what a precentor was. So when I was I was ordained in 2023, I was in Enfield as my first placement, and then the Vicar General rang me to say, "Well, we would like you to come to Westminster Cathedral to be the precentor." And I remember I said, "Oh, what is that?" So I definitely didn't see it coming. No.
Wow. Oh, well, look, you as I said earlier, you have appeared on this podcast before.
Yes, I have.
Absolutely. The last time, actually, if you remember, we were in, I hasten to call it a green room, but before a live event in Twickenham at the theatre there, we had a chat about art and the afterlife with Baroness Sheila Hollins and the wonderful Lynn Handley, didn't we?
Yes, which was a wonderful evening, actually. And talking about, so I spoke about art and beauty and how all of that can help us to deal with the afterlife and with death in particular. And does beauty have a role to play within these final moments of a person's life?
Well, we're going to get into that, of course. Now, we've touched on it, as you say. But what I thought we'd do today is look at four main areas. We'll look at sacred music, which is an interesting one, and how it accompanies death and dying, perhaps. The auction room and mortality.
An interesting one.
We haven't covered that before. I will expand on that. As you say, beauty, faith, art, how it links to a life beyond this one. And finally, what as Catholics would probably call the most solemn and holy period of our year, the sacred Triduum, the incredible drama of Christ's journey to the cross, his passion, death, and of course, resurrection. So plenty to talk about. Shall we start with sacred music?
Yes.
Let's do that, because you talked about your role at Westminster Cathedral and you've just had a concert, haven't you, in March? Very interesting. I'm going to hopefully pronounce this correctly. The Stabat Mater, and it was Sir James Macmillan's arrangement, his composition, wasn't it?
Yes.
So tell us a bit about that.
It's a very beautiful composition, which I think premiered in 2018. So it's a relatively new piece of music. And every year for Lent, the music department, so the Master of Music, decides in Westminster Cathedral to host and put on a concert. So traditionally, it's often the Bach Passions that are played. And so this year, he wanted something much more contemporary. And James Macmillan's Stabat Mater is a very, it's almost a haunting piece of music, because it's literally describing Mary at the foot of the cross. So the music is set to this beautiful 13th century poem by Jacopo da Todi. So it's not a very long poem. And that is good, because I think when music is not too text heavy, then the music can just float and go off in all directions. And I think that's why this particular piece works so well. And yes, and just before the piece of music, the actual concert, we had an interview with Sir James Macmillan for about half an hour, 40 minutes, where he explained what we were actually about to listen to. And I think that really helped, because as I said, it's a difficult piece of music. And so having him talk about how he composed it, what he wanted to convey in his music, certainly helped everybody who was there.
And tell me a bit about how he chose to convey Mary specifically at the foot of the cross. I think it's fascinating to actually listen to something like that in the presence of the composer, especially a preeminent composer like Sir James Macmillan. Did he sort of explain that sort of how the pathos comes through, the sort of perhaps hope in darkness and all those things?
Yes, I mean, all of that is very present. However, it's very much about the sorrow of Mary. So the whole piece, it's roughly an hour in length. So the whole piece is really about Mary's sorrow at the foot of the cross. She sees her son above her, literally dripping with blood that is falling on top of her. And I mean, how, as a mother, can you go through these moments? So it's a very difficult piece. And he spoke about how, when he was composing it, that he had to enter that space, the foot of the cross, every day, get to that almost spiritually sort of very dark place to empathize with the feelings of Mary. And then there's the text of the poem, which I said, but then that the music then sort of conveys and complements all of that. And I think that's where music is at its most powerful, where words can sort of are always very limited. Music is sort of unlimited and can really broaden that whole scope.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because when we talk specifically about death and dying, sometimes, you know, if someone's had a terminal diagnosis, or if someone is on that path to their death, words are difficult to come by, aren't they? And music clearly is a matter of consolation as well. How do you see music's role in that sort of walk towards death and what comes after?
I'd say probably that music helps us to rehearse for eternity, if I can put it that way. And as you say, music, it's where words lack, then music help. And in my young sort of life as a priest, I've been a priest now nearly 3 years, I've often found that in very difficult moments, when you talk to families just at the point when someone is about to die or after a bereavement, that actually music is something that almost instinctively these families go to. That it brings consolation, it puts them in touch with something spiritual, it elevates them from the difficult day-to-day that they might have to cope with. So in that sense, music is very helpful in the art of dying, as your podcast and in these moments of bereavement.
And I guess somewhat similarly to art, and we can talk about whether art is music and how interchangeable that is, everyone consumes differently, don't they? So when you mention family members, they're going to have a different attitude about what music should mean, either in remembrance or in accompaniment, to the person themselves that's dying, for instance, who might want some different aspects of consolation, and they might even want to choose their own music for their own funeral, for instance.
Yes.
So it is similar to art in that sort of consumption way, isn't it?
Yes, and it always helps us as priests when, say, the person who's died made express wishes as to what he or she wants at the funeral. Because, yes, if there are four children who are arranging the funeral, often the four children will have four very different tastes, and music that will speak to each of them in a very different way. So it's always very helpful to plan, and certainly we as a priest, we can advise as to what music would be suitable. But again, a lot of it is based on then our own personal preferences.
Now, I'm not going to get into the quiet revival and more young people coming to church, which is a wonderful thing, of course, you know, as referenced by the recent numbers of those that will be received into the church at Easter. But young people seem to sort of, their attitude is changing a bit in that they want something serious and tangible. And, you know, they want, I get that feeling young people want to be anchored in something. And they want to be closer to Christ in something they see as defined and tangible. Do you think that in that sense, sacred music might play more of a role for young people than it would have done in the past? Are they more interested in sacred music, do you think, than they were before?
I think so, because sacred music is unlike any other music. Sacred music doesn't just ask the listener just to listen to the music. It asks the listener to enter into the music. And I think when we have young people who come to the cathedral and hear our cathedral choir, it touches them because they know that it's actually more than just about the music. They know that there is inherently some truth in there, not just beauty, but this beauty that leads us to truth and to God, and they can almost instinctively feel it. The only thing is that most young people would always tell me that it's something that you have to experience live, be there at church and listen to it. So still very few of them would go home and actually start listening to sacred music on their iPhones or their iPods or whatever. So I think in a sense that makes sense, because sacred music is experiential, that you have to experience it. And so if you experience it live as part of sacred liturgy and a mass, then you basically get the full package, if I can put it that way.
Oh, absolutely. And in a sense, without making more comparisons with art, I remember once going into the National Gallery and thinking, wow, that almost looks like a chapel, you know, the way the installation is through various galleries. And I thought, well, actually, even if I had this awe-inspiring masterpiece on my wall in my flat, I don't think it would be beautiful, but I'm not sure it would have the same impact on me. So that, again, where something is situated in terms of art and in terms of music is quite important, isn't it?
Yes, and I mean, artists across the ages have always understood that, and we as a church have always understood that. That's why we are the only religion in the world who's always been so serious about the arts, because everything complements one another. It's the architecture of the church, and then placed within it sacred music, placed within it paintings, sculpture, the liturgical vessels that get used. So everything is incredibly coherent and hangs together. So when you see a painting, a beauty, even the most wonderful of sacred paintings in a museum, it'll never give you that same experience as saying Michelangelo's Pietà at the back of St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. Then it feels you're looking at this amazing artwork, and it's in its proper context as well.
Oh, and that has its place in Holy Week, so we'll come on to that, no doubt. Shall we segue nicely into the auction room and mortality?
Ooh.
Interesting, eh? Bet you didn't think you'd be answering questions on this one.
No.
Well, I suppose I want to start by asking, well, what does the auction room, in a sense, reveal about our mortality? Life, death, dying, and perhaps beyond, because, you know, people die, of course, but works of art don't necessarily. Works that once meant everything to someone, now gone, remain in this world. Collections are passed on or sold. Is there a sensitivity in handling art that, you know, for instance, was really special to someone who has died? Is there an added value, perhaps, that can't be measured in coins or notes, for instance?
Wow, there's a lot in everything.
Big question.
Yes. I think in a funny way, being an auctioneer has sort of prepared me well for the priesthood, and I know that might sound very strange. When you are an auctioneer, you are dealing with families who are either planning for a death in the family or after a bereavement, and then the items need to get sold. So you are always you're very regularly dealing with people in very sensitive situations where you have to be very sensitive and understanding and understanding to their needs and to this moment that they live in. But I think what taught me the most, probably as an auctioneer, is that at the end of the day, collecting, having the most wonderful art in one's house, you only own it for a little amount of time. Yeah. We're always only just temporary custodians of artworks. And even the biggest collectors, the Gettys, the Guggenheims, at the end of the day, it ends up in a museum. Yes, an amazing museum. But this ownership is gone after death. So in that sense, it's been a good preparation, holding a gavel.
Absolutely. And it got me thinking when I knew I was going to have the privilege of speaking to you, that, you know, I started to think about the life of, let's say, a painting, for want of another expression, the life of a painting. You know, it passes through so many hands. It's actually quite profound, isn't it, that a work of art can live, not just in the here and now, but in the future as well.
Yes, and most works of art that we admire now, that I admire and love, they will long outlive me. So it's always this same question of the temporal in the world, whatever it is, if it's a tree, a flower, an artwork, our own lives. At the end of the day, everything in this world, sooner or later, fades and dies. And yeah. Once you realize that, then the only option is to then be serious about the eternal.
And you do have people that will sell works of art that not only meant a lot to their, let's just say, grandmother, grandfather, father, mother, but there is a reluctance to sell sometimes. Sometimes there's a need to sell, but there's a reluctance to sell. Have you ever had those cases where someone probably would rather keep it because it's a memento, let's say, or it's got that remembrance aspect, but they have to sell it? That's a different dimension, isn't it?
Yes, often people, I mean, there are always a myriad of different circumstances when people have to sell. But yes, often there is this great sentimental value that they've had, I don't know, people from, say, a noble family, but the house is crumbling. They have to sell a painting that's been in the family for 300-400 years. It is very painful to sell. And then you have to be there as an auctioneer to guiding them gently through that difficult moment in their life, because it goes far beyond just selling an artwork, because you have all the complexities that come into it about saving the family home, or they've made bad investments, and so there's this tremendous sense of guilt that now they have to sell the family home with all the artwork in it. So usually, you, as an auctioneer, especially for sort of big collections or important artworks, you always enter in a very sensitive situation, which I think, again, as I said earlier, is often what you find as a priest as well, that people reach out to a priest at the moment in time where they really need help.
Yeah, absolutely. And if we just sort of talk about those vanitas pieces, I believe that was a Dutch movement, was it? The vanitas genre?
Yes, mainly Dutch. I mean, it happened in Flanders and in Italy as well. But it's the Dutch masters basically cornered that market very much so.
And we talked about memento mori, haven't we?
Yes,
And that sort of artwork. Yeah. Did you handle a lot of that sort of artwork? Not at all? Sometimes?
Yes, sometimes. Sometimes, because at the time in the 17th century, in the Dutch golden age of painting, just a lot was produced. These studios, often one painter worked with 30, 40 people in a studio. So there was just an enormous output, a large quantity of artworks. So which means that still nowadays, a lot of these type of paintings often come on the market. But it's a bit of a puzzle, isn't it? And I think I have to talk to parents as well about it when they say, oh, Father, what would be a fun artwork for my children? I want them to look at art. What should they look at? And I often mention Vanitas paintings because then the children can identify the lemon. What could it mean?
The lemon.
Or a glass that's half full, the fragility of life. Or an oyster that's open, or I don't know, just all these different things that are present in these paintings. And it's a bit of a quest for the children to look at this type of art.
They get what a skull is. That's a bit more obvious, isn't it?
Yes. Exactly, yes.
No,
yes.
I find it fascinating, absolutely. So, final question on the auction room and mortality. In terms of pieces you've handled that are more Christian in their nature, Do you, with the gavel in hand, have you ever been sort of moved by a piece where you've got a job to do and it's got its certain rhyme and reason and, you know, you've got your eye on the room and everything, but you've stopped and thought, wow, have you ever been moved like that?
Yes, definitely. And I think as an auctioneer, when you're standing on the rostrum and you're holding an auction, and there's a lot, particular lot coming up, say lot 256, and you're auctioning lot 248, and you know in 8 lots' time this beautiful crucifix by, say, Al Ghardi will come up. Your wish, I mean, certainly as a Christian and as a Catholic, you want that piece to find a good home.
Yeah.
So if then a museum buys it, you feel like, ah, great, it'll be secure there. or say a religious institution, then fine. And then when you're auctioneering, then you wish that it just finds a good home. And I think there's always a personal bit of emotional involvement as well when you're standing there holding the gavel.
And I said final question on this segment, but I got another one. So in terms of you know, when people are sort of clearing houses on a bit of the lower level, let's say, potentially, I mean, everyone wants to find a masterpiece, don't they, that they never knew was up there gathering dust or whatever. Has anyone had a particular piece of religious significance that they haven't realized had great value? Have you come across anything like that?
Yes, I mean, there were discoveries every year. I mean, by my colleagues at Sotheby's, it was sort of year in, year out. There were maybe 5 big discoveries, or whether that was in the realm of ancient Roman art or old master paintings or sculpture or whatever. The one I probably recall the best, because I was involved, was a painting in a monastery in Austria. And I'm not a painting expert myself. My own specialty is antique furniture. And my colleagues in the old master painting department said, oh, Patrick, well, you go to church, and why don't you go to the monastery and go and have a look at that painting next time you're in Austria. So I go and see the painting, talk to Mother Superior, take photographs of the front and back of the painting, and it looked absolutely astonishing. I come back to London, show the photographs to my colleagues, and they say, wow, this is very good quality. Maybe this is by Peter Paul Rubens.
Oh.
Anyway, cutting a very long story short, they did all the research. Then back to Austria to say to the sisters, well, the estimates of this painting that you have in your dining room that you've been living with so long is 8 to 12 million. What would you like to do with the painting? Oh, well, it's a bit too expensive for us to have, and there's many costs to the monastery, so selling it. And at the time, it was, I think it was in 2007, 2008, so you couldn't watch the auction room live yet on the internet. So we said, well, I'll give you a call after the auction to say how much it sold for. So painting got sold, bring the sisters, and they said, did it sell well? Yes. How much did it sell for? Well, are you sitting down? £48 million.
So £48 million?
Yes, yeah. So there are these, I mean, that was completely an unknown painting. It was lost since the late 18th century. Nobody knew where this painting was by Rubens, The Massacre of the Innocents. a tough painting to look at because it's got all these dead babies in it that have just been killed. So, I mean, as the subject sort of commands, a very difficult painting. So, I mean, that was just one of the discoveries, but it still happens. There was a Caravaggio discovered only a few weeks ago, so it's great. So,
what happens to your heart when that happens, by the way? When you suddenly realise, actually, goodness me, this is quite an incredible piece.
As an owner or an auctioneer, you mean?
When you discover it as an auctioneer.
I mean, it's very exciting. Usually what happens is that it's a slow process of discovery. Mm. You have this initial sort of gut feeling that when you look at, say, this painting, that you say, this could be actually something interesting. But it's actually then slowly, with the research, then it unveils itself, actually how important it is, which maybe you didn't realize at the beginning. And then, it is very, very exciting. And they become these works of art become your friends that you go on a little journey with. And then once the hammer comes down, it goes back to storage and then gets shipped to the buyer and you never see it again.
Goodness me.
So it's a very different setup than, say, working in a museum where you tend to work with the same objects for a long time. And the auction world has got this sort of aspect of spending 4 or 5 months with an object and then, boom, it's gone again.
Goodness me, that's outstanding. Let's talk about that art as being that gateway to the transcendent, you know, beauty as a guide to living and dying well. First of all, I'd like to talk about your forthcoming inaugural Christian.art conference that you have in the autumn, in November, is it this year?
Yeah, 14th of November, Saturday 14th.
I can't imagine many people don't know what Christian.art is, but let's start there. Tell us what it is, how you decided to found it, what your inspiration was, and a little bit about the conference that will happen later this year.
I started writing, I set up Christian Art when I was in seminary. In my seminary room, and in a way for me, because needless to say, it's a big step to move from the art world into training for the priesthood. And I started, the initial idea was I want to hang on to something of the old life. And so when I look at my writings from 6 years ago, then it's very much 80% is about the art and 20% is about the spiritual, because I just didn't have that language yet to speak about God and about religion and spirituality. And so as I worked my way through seminary, this balance sort of slightly shifted. But the idea is simple. It's just the gospel of the day that I pair with an artwork every day. And then I write a little reflection upon it. And sometimes, but actually rarely, the artwork is a straight sort of illustration of what's said in the gospel reading. So if it's the raising of Lazarus, then sometimes the painting is depicting the raising of Lazarus. But more times than ever, it's actually more of an indirect link. So say if it's the woman anointing the feet of Jesus at the table, then I might look at an ancient Roman first century glass jar, perfume bottle and oil jar, so that actually we would get a sense, okay, what did the object look like that is described in the Bible. So, and it ranges from literally Roman art, as I've just mentioned, to contemporary art, because one has to appeal, well, it's my personal taste, I sort of like all art, but it's important to try and throw the net as wide as we can and try and capture a lot of young people as well. So we look at contemporary art as well.
It's wonderful. It's a real inspiration. I mean, without too many plugs, I'm sure there's so many examples, but my daughter uses it every day. She's a chaplain in a secondary school.
Gosh.
So, you know, I don't know, I'm sure you know how far it reaches, but it's still nice to hear these little sort of individual punctuation points where people really are using it for the furthering of the kingdom and deepening their own faith. So, I mean, huge congratulations. Tell us about the event then.
So the event is, because the main reason behind it is that everything is online at the moment.
Yeah.
So people tell me that they read it, but I would actually love to meet some of the people who are as passionate about sacred art as I am. And that's basically the reason why we're doing the conference, is for 1,300 people to get together and to celebrate our joint passion for art. So it's a day's conference. We've got Neil McGregor, Gabriele Finaldi from the National Gallery. We've got Cardinal Timothy Ratcliffe. We've got Rowan Williams, because we look at Christian art, not necessarily just Catholic art. We've got Matthew Saunders from Magisterium AI, which is AI at the service of the church. Trying to have a wide scope of different speakers. But a day is not very long, so we can only have so many speakers.
So you're trying to get people away from their little screens and their slightly bigger screens and into a bit of face-to-face, authentic human contact.
Yes, exactly. And we'll have stalls of the various ministries that will be there as well. And so it'll be a joyful day.
Well, I know you've enjoyed me asking you these big, difficult questions, all-encompassing questions. Here's another. So how does beauty and the depiction of it shape the way we live and, more crucially, the way we prepare to die?
Ooh.
Big.
First half of your question, how does it shape us? I think a good way of looking at it is that all of us are always very mindful of what we eat, and the press is full of it. And if we eat the wrong food, we just get a bit bigger. If we eat the wrong food,
just know it.
Yes. So food affects our bodies directly. And what we see and what we look at is exactly the same way. It affects us directly. So what we look at will feed and nurture our souls in a particular way. So if you look at ugly things, then it'll affect our soul in one way. If we look at beautiful things, it'll affect our soul in a different way. So seeing is incredibly important. And I think as a church, we've always understood that.
Yeah.
Because it's in our human activities, seeing is the most important thing. Like, we are talking now, but in a few minutes, or however long this interview is, I leave.
I'm keeping you here for a while.
Yeah, the act of speaking will finish. Mm-hmm. Or when I walk back to the cathedral, the act of walking is finished. With seeing, it's different. Because if I close my eyes now, I can still see you. I can still see things. Or I go to bed, I dream of things. Seeing always continues. And so it's the activity that influences us the most as human beings.
Wow. That's very, very profound. And in terms of that, you know, beauty in accompaniment to our death, or perhaps accompaniment in grief, how should we reflect upon the beauty of a work and what it can mean to us at those times in our life or death?
Well, beauty puts us in touch with God, the via pulchritudinis, the way of beauty. And I think especially towards the end of life, we get this sense that when we think about God, that we might maybe listen to a bit of music that helps us to connect with God. Or if I want to print a little memorial card for, I don't know, my father who's died, then you want to make that look as beautiful as you can in order, as a tribute to your father, but also more because you want it to be beautiful to put on a mantelpiece to remind you of that person and to say a little prayer. So beauty is this great conduit that, to put us in touch with God, I think.
Oh, very well put. Yeah. But then talking about beauty, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I might look at the Barbican Centre and say it looks beautiful, but it's quite brutal. It's got cold, hard lines in it. So I suppose what you interpret as beauty can change from person to person in that sense, can't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole question then. Is beauty really in the eye of the beholder? And is it purely subjective? Or is this something as objective beauty? And when you then look at the great sort of theologians over the ages, then they would all argue that there is something as objective beauty. And I fully agree with that. We can sort of sense it. If, say, I say, well, I think the interior of Westminster Cathedral is the most beautiful interior of any church in the world, you will say, okay, well, that's your opinion, but I've got a different opinion. And we wouldn't, yeah, we would talk about it, but we wouldn't argue about it. But if I was to take you, say, in the Sistine Chapel, and say in the Sistine Chapel to you, oh, I just think this is absolute rubbish, then you would be absolutely shocked, because you would know that that beauty that you're surrounded with in the Sistine Chapel is actually objective beauty. It goes beyond the merely subjectively pleasing. And that's what artists, especially medieval and Renaissance artists, understood so well, that if they create works of art that are just so beautiful, it actually transcends this moment of space, time, and will appeal to people of generations to come. And that is why we still flock to museums to see all these beautiful works of art, because many of them sort of get into that realm of objective beauty.
That's absolutely fascinating. Well, we're going to move on to Christ and beauty and the memorial celebration of his passion, death, resurrection. They are those important days for us. We call them the sacred or paschal triduum, coming up at the end of Holy Week. In fact, on the Bishop's Conference website for England and Wales, we did a small series that we've been using for a few years, The Art of Holy Week, where we looked at four pieces over those days. 3 days, four pieces. But nonetheless, I think about Christ in particular, and there are many, we talked about beauty a second ago, there are many depictions of Christ. Some are very strong and muscular, others slightly less so. Some are heartrending in the graphic nature of his passion, for instance, others less graphic, let's say. Do you find that your relationship with Christ is at all altered by what you see of these depictions of his passion and death and resurrection?
Not necessarily altered, but it invites me to look at Christ in a different way. And I think each artist brings that to the table. If you look at a beautiful, I mean, coming up to Easter now, so if you look at a crucifixion, say the Grunewald, the Isenheim altarpiece, where Christ looks twisted, contorted, painfully skinny, and incredibly difficult painting to look at. But for me, that is as valuable, and that invites me to connect them with Jesus and to say, wow, you did all this for us. And you really see how far-reaching his sacrifice was for us. And then you compare it to, say, a more graceful crucifixion of the Middle Ages. Then you look at, wow, gosh, Jesus, you look beautiful there on the cross. And I give my prayers to you on the cross, so you can give them to God and help me and whatever. So I think all these different artworks help us to connect with the same reality in very different ways.
And the stations are always, of course, particularly moving and actually experiential in a sense to us, aren't they, when we meditate on the passion of Christ.
Yes.
I'm going to give a little plug to something I saw a week or two back. You know what I'm going to say here, that Wintershall collaboration where you looked at the stations of the cross.
Yes.
Absolutely marvellous. Perhaps we'll put a link to from this podcast to that. There's something quite specific about those stations and how they're depicted, isn't there, in terms of our relationship with Christ?
Yes. I mean, I'll come to the video in a minute, but I think the stations is just, it's my most preferred devotion of the whole year. And I'm incredibly lucky and grateful to work at the cathedral, because every Friday night after the 5:30 Mass, so about 6:15, 6:30, the whole parish, we pray the stations. And we move around the cathedral, and it's like a big cloud of people, 300-400 people move from station 1 all the way around the cathedral to station 14. And it makes us literally a crowd there at the foot of the cross and watching what Jesus did. And it's a very beautiful thing. And that is what we wanted to replicate in the video that we did with Christian Art on the 14 stations of the cross, which I think, I looked a few days ago, it hit over 1.2 million
views. Yes, I noticed that.
Because we put it out a year ago, and it, and I think before the start of Lent, it had 600,000 views, and then now with Lent, must be that people are searching online to pray the Stations of the Cross. And the video was very much designed for people to pray with, to literally press play and to pray the 14 stations with. And the Wintershall Theatre Company, who reenact the Passion Play on Trafalgar Square, it was a joy to work with them, because what we've done is they depict the 14 stations and we slow down their movements to an incredibly slow video footage, so it becomes incredibly meditational.
Slow motion. You start to focus on each person and their role in the Passion, in a sense, don't you? Every turn, really.
Yes, yeah.
People that hadn't have thought to look at, and sometimes you sort of think, oh, there's something going on just almost off screen.
Yes.
And you start to focus on that for a little while, even though the high drama, let's say, might be going on front and centre.
Yes.
It's wonderful at that speed, because you start to consider, I'm not saying ordinary people like us, but you imagine, it literally does take you to the foot of the cross, doesn't it?
Yes, yes.
You wonder what it would be like if you had been one of those people watching on. Very skilled. Honestly, I can't commend it highly enough. I think it's wonderful.
No, thank you.
Very, very good. This is going to put you on the spot a bit. So if we're looking at the Paschal Triduum, the Sacred Triduum, what works of art would you pick that would move you and mean the most to you to, if you like, document that period?
I would probably...
Not giving you an easy ride here.
Do you want artist names? I would probably choose... There's a painting by Hans Memling which depicts the Stations of the Cross and the whole Passion of Jesus. But it's much more than just 14 stations. It depicts other scenes. And it's a wonderful painting to look at. And again, as parents with children, it's a wonderful painting to look at. And just to ask the kids to identify all the different things that are depicted in there. But probably, having grown up in Bruges and Flanders, probably the painting that I would choose would be Ruyer van der Weyden's Descent of the Cross. It's just such a moving piece of art. And it's at the very beginning of oil painting, because oil paint was invented in Flanders around sort of 1400s, while in Italy they were still painting with tempera and with different mediums. At its time, it was incredibly revolutionary, because all of a sudden there's this burst of colours that the world had never seen that are now fixed onto a panel there to stay. So they're very, very striking and very beautiful paintings. And it's the first time as well that emotion is entering these crucifixion scenes, or the sense of the cross, or the resurrection. So it's the first time emotion in a very measured way is entering art history.
Whoa, wonderful. Two good suggestions. I'm going to put our listeners onto those. And my own family, of course. So in terms of depictions of Jesus Christ, we know that there are many crucifixion scenes. How many sort of scenes of ministry are there, or the time before the Passion?
I think probably half and half, if I had to put a number on it, yes. You start seeing after the Middle Ages, because Middle Ages, yes, is very much crucifixes or Marian sculptures, but yeah, mainly sort of crucifixes. And then as you move through art history, and Renaissance, because Renaissance is all about then perspective, human emotion that comes into it, not just we are looking at the life of Christ, but actually how do I feel when I look at Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead, not just depicted anymore as like a distant event in the first century, but no, how would I, if I place myself in the scene, how do I consider this scene? That's what artists then started doing. And so then they start exploring all these different scenes of the life of Christ. And it was incredibly liberating to the artists that now all these patrons of the arts, including the church, were saying, well, actually, if we want to educate people and tell them about the life of Christ, we just have to offer a much broader range of subjects than just, say, art that's so closely linked to the Triduum.
Final question. So often with people that are unchurched or maybe curious or maybe not at all, it can be a work of art that moves them towards Christ, towards God. How can I put it? Why can something like that move someone enough to in fact change their whole worldview and look to Christ, do you think?
Because beauty is transcendental, and it puts us in touch with something that is far greater than us. And if I just you asked the question. So there was this wonderful theologian in the 1960s called Hans Urs von Balthasar, a Swiss priest. And he spoke about truth, goodness, and beauty. I mean, he didn't invent them. He says these are the transcendentals, so which means transcendental, that they transcend time and space. So if you were a Roman officer in the second century, you wanted to know the truth about things, just like we now still want to know the truth about what goes on around us. So we have this innate sense of the truth, the goodness and the beautiful. And he said in the 1960s, he said, as a church, we've always started in the pews by telling people, okay, let me tell you what the truth is. And you have to believe this. And then once you know the truth, out of that will flow good lives that you will start leading. And then out of that, there'll be space to create beauty. And von Balthasar said, there will be a time that will come when the church pews will empty themselves. And at that stage, so he's very visionary, at that stage, we will have to start the other way around. We'll have to start with beauty and then work our way up to goodness and to truth. And I fully agree with that, that beauty is this non-intimidating inroad into the faith. And that's why, as a church, we have to become very serious again, I think, about beauty and the arts, because it's not just something nice and fluffy and to decorate our walls with. No, it's actually the perfect inroad, especially in a heavy secularized society, that you just say to someone, okay, you don't go to church, you don't go to mass, but just come and sit here for half an hour with me and listen to this this piece of music in the church, and then something will happen to these people, and then it's up to the Holy Spirit to do his work.
And do you think we're at that point now?
I think so. I remember before I entered seminary, I went regularly to Vespers at Westminster Cathedral because I lived close by. And I said to friends quite regularly, okay, let's meet for dinner tonight. But before we go for drinks and dinner, why don't you come at 5 o'clock and there's something I want you to listen to. And I say, well, I don't go to church. I don't go to mass. You go and then we'll meet up. I said, no, please do it for me. And so they came to Vespers. They hear this beautiful Latin Gregorian or polyphonic chants of the Vespers. Never said anything at the time, but lo and behold, always at some point in the evening, they would say, what was that thing that we listened to 3 hours ago? Ah, it's the praise of the church. We sing it the same thing everywhere in the world. Really? Gosh. And so because of them being moved by the beauty of the music, it opened that door. And I think that's one of our major tools that we have as a church in our arsenal is beauty, and we should use it.
And do you think that's the same door to consolation in the event of death and grief?
Yes, absolutely. It's all interlinked, absolutely.
Father Patrick van der Voorst, thank you so much. That's packed, isn't it? We've gone almost up to the hour mark looking at sacred music, looking at the auction room and mortality. Fascinating stuff. Never covered that before. And of course, the gateway to the transcendent. Thank you so much. I think we've really had a really good insight into how all these things, these wonderful, beautiful things, can give us consolation in life and in death. So thank you very much, and we'll give a little plug to that event that I should like to come to as well in November.
Great. Thank you very much, James.
Thank you.